It's Wednesday, March 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, American voters have spoken. We'll find out what they said and who might be the next U.S. president. International trade becomes local to voters in Ohio.
They have created a situation where Assad government is clearly more powerful.
Russia draws down forces in Syria, but many fighters remain. Also ahead, Islamic State and atrocities. Virtual reality on your smartphone. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio has dropped out of the presidential race after television networks projected Donald Trump to beat him badly in his home state. Trump also lost Ohio to that state's governor, John Kasich. Trump won Florida by a huge margin over second-place finisher Rubio, and Texas Senator Ted Cruz and Kasich were far behind. Florida, a winner-take-all state, meaning that Trump is getting all 99 delegates out of there without having to split them with the runners-up. Ohio, also another winner-take-all state. And Kasich's win over Trump will keep that governor's campaign alive. He said he's going to travel across the country and predicted that he'll be very competitive in the upcoming primaries, noting that there's still about 1,000 delegates to be picked. Well, to sort all of this out, we're joined by VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone. To put it all in perspective, Jim.
Good to see you, Jim.
So, Donald Trump coming away with some big wins tonight.
He did indeed. He did not win in Ohio, and the significance there is not only does John Kasich get to stay in the race, he may be able to rally the Republican establishment around him now. He may try to get some of the Rubio supporters with him. But it also keeps open at least the possibility that Donald Trump, as doing well as he is, may not get the delegates he needs before the convention to have the nomination sewn up before the convention in Cleveland in July. That leaves open a sliver of a possibility that somehow he could be denied the nomination by what's called a contested convention. But it still looks like a long shot.
That could be quite interesting. And, of course, Texas Senator Ted Cruz in the thick of that with Donald Trump.
Right. And Ted Cruz now says he's the only one who's beaten Trump enough to be considered his chief rival. Look, it is a three-person race now with Kasich and Trump. Trump's well ahead. He's going to continue to gain delegates. And if he can win some of the upcoming states like Arizona with winner-take-all, it's going to reinforce the idea that even though he may not get to the convention with all the votes he needs, he's going to have most of them, and it's really going to be difficult for the party to kind of turn away from him at the last minute.
Now, among the Democrats, of course, it's been down to two, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders pulled out a win.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders looking narrowly good in Missouri at the moment. But you know what? That's the silver lining and otherwise a pretty dark cloud for Bernie Sanders. Hillary Clinton thrashed him in Florida, easily won in North Carolina, and had a big win in Ohio. I actually think the Clinton win in Ohio is nearly decisive. It shows that she's winning in these bigger states. Sanders will remain in the race. He can continue to accrue delegates. But here's the problem. He would have to win by 60% or almost 70% of the remaining delegates to overtake her. And that's just not very likely. So I actually think that this primary night was a decisively good night for Hillary Clinton. It doesn't mean she's going to be able to flush him out of the race anytime soon, but she has a huge lead in delegates.
So at the moment, it appears like we have really a two-person race coming down to the conventions. It's going to be Hillary Clinton for the Democrats and probably Donald Trump.
And she was already focused on Trump in her victory remarks tonight, talking about the politics of fear, as was Marco Rubio. So the Trump narrative continues to drive the race, but he hasn't quite sewn up the nomination yet.
VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone with us live in the studio. Jim, thank you so much for giving us the perspective on all of the voters' actions today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
We stay with Super Tuesday now and have our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, in the studio to tell us what's buzzing online. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. The trending hashtag, of course, was hashtag Super Tuesday throughout the day, although it was a bit of a mini Super Tuesday. Of all the states that voted today, Florida was the most closely watched state online, with hashtag Florida Primary trending both on Facebook and Twitter. There were 99 winner-take-all delegates up for grabs in Florida on the Republican side. The Democrats had 214 delegates at stake.
What did some of the contenders post on Facebook?
The leading GOP contender Donald Trump wrote, "A fabulous day in North Carolina, Florida, and Ohio. Remember to get out and vote Trump. I will defeat Hillary Clinton, and we will make America great again." He wasn't even talking about his Republican rivals here, so that's the level of confidence he's projecting to his supporters. And turns out, he had an even more fabulous evening. By the way, one of his tweets was widely covered by news outlets today, and it reads like this. "A lot of complaints from people saying my name is not on the ballot in various places in Florida. Hope this is false."
Wow, so what's going on there? Is there any clarification from the state election officials?
Jim, they said his name was not left out in ballots. Florida is a closed primary state, as you know, so which means only registered Republicans would get a ballot listing the candidates. The confusion began when some residents in Jupiter, Florida, voting in municipal elections, complained they didn't see Trump's name on the ballot.
I see. So what are the other presidential hopefuls saying on social media today?
Florida Senator Marco Rubio was really banking on his home state to turn the tide around, writing, "It all comes down to Florida" on Facebook. It didn't really go well for him there. Turning to the Democratic side, frontrunner Hillary Clinton's team live-blogged the developments on Facebook note. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders focused heavily on increasing the voter turnout. His success was largely dependent on the voter turnout. That's all for me today, Jim.
Well, thanks for the analysis, G. You may follow her on Twitter at GAbbyLee. I also post there as well at VOA Stevenson. And be sure to follow our International Edition stream. That is at VOA underscore IE. We focus on Republican Ohio Governor John Kasich's win now in Ohio and some of the economic issues that voters there were facing. Newsweek political correspondent Emily Cadet tells us that foreign trade is very much in the discussion.
Now, Ohio is one of these states that, along with Illinois and Missouri, which are also voted, is, you know, part of the Rust Belt, and it's been hit by a sort of long, slow decline in the American manufacturing sector. And so trade, foreign trade, which a lot of voters blame for the decline in manufacturing, has become a hot-button issue in the presidential race, and it really flared up ahead of the Michigan election, which was last week, and ended with a pretty surprise result, particularly on the Democratic side, with Bernie Sanders upsetting Hillary Clinton there and really hammering the trade issue. But even on the Republican side, you had Donald Trump emphasizing his opposition to trade deals in Michigan. And so as a result of that outcome, we've seen a huge increase in the amount that trade and trade deals have been talked about in this presidential race. And Trump sort of hammering John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, in the lead up to this race over Kasich's support of free trade in the past. Sanders hammering Clinton over her more nuanced stand on trade. And so it really has been driving the discussion in the lead up to tonight's vote.
Of course, for Kasich, Ohio is his home state, a very important outcome in that state. He's saying, well, you know, I've had success in my state with trade and supporting trade deals.
One of the things that we've seen is the Republican Party having to defend trade in a way that I don't think a lot of these candidates are used to, particularly not in a primary like this. John Kasich will argue that he's been a supporter of fair trade and free trade. You know, he's always looking out for the American worker first, but he doesn't want to pursue any deals that would give them, you know, a bad deal. There's a lot of skepticism about this latest deal that President Obama's administration has negotiated, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and that's, I think, hurting all of the candidates who tend to be more pro-free trade, just because so many people in so many different industries are very skeptical of how that is going to play out. And so you have Trump out there talking about how bad TPP is and that John Kasich supports it, and Sanders talking about how Clinton supported it when she was at the State Department. And so that's hurting them, I think, with the average voter up there in Ohio. And not only Ohio, but Illinois, Missouri. I think it hurt them in Michigan as well.
It's an interesting position for the Republicans to be in. They were more in support of what President Obama was doing in this particular deal than his own Democrats were.
Yeah, it's an interesting sort of example of unlikely bedfellows in Congress when it comes to this latest trade negotiation. You have the middle of the Democratic Party, the more centrist Democrats, along with a big swath of the Republican Party that really is supporting that negotiation and supporting ratification, which hasn't come up for a full vote in Congress yet. But certainly President Obama really relied on Republicans to push through the first procedural step in approving that trade deal, more so than his Democratic allies. For Republicans, you know, in a place like Ohio, Kasich's whole pitch has been based on the Ohio economic comeback story, which he would argue trade is a part of. You know, Democrats will tell you that Kasich really can't take any credit for the Ohio economic revival such as it's been, and it's certainly not as good as a lot of parts of the country, but compared to where they were, it's better. They would argue that it's, you know, general improving economic conditions that's really been driven by President Obama and his policies rather than anything John Kasich's done. So there's a lot of moving parts in all of this, and it's obviously a lot more complex than either side is really letting on right now. It all fits into this bigger debate about who's going to be better for the economy in a part of the country where they're still hurting from a lot of jobs that have left and just haven't been replaced in the way they were promised to be.
The Newsweek article is about Ohio election and trade, and the political correspondent is Emily Cadet. Emily, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So many stories in the road to the White House this year as the election campaigns roll on. Stay with the Voice of America as we bring you all of the different angles leading up to the next president of the United States. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Russian Defense Ministry Tuesday said it has begun withdrawing some of its military equipment sent to Syria after President Vladimir Putin on Monday surprisingly announced a partial withdrawal from the country nearly 5 months after it began an air campaign in support of the Bashar al-Assad regime in Damascus. Mr. Putin said he believes the goal set out by the Russian armed forces in Syria has in large part been fulfilled, and that, in his words, the fundamental turnaround in the fight against international terrorism. The White House says President Obama discussed the matter with his Russian counterpart by phone. White House spokesman Josh Earnest on Monday said Moscow's military presence has hindered a political settlement to the five-year conflict.
We have talked about how Russia's continued military intervention to prop up the Assad regime made the efforts to reach a political transition or to make a political transition even more difficult. That as long as Russia was aggressively weighing in militarily, they were removing at least part of the incentive for the regime to even engage in those kinds of conversations. So I haven't seen the reports, so it's hard for me to assess at this point what sort of impact this will have on the talks, what kind of change this will bring about to that dynamic. So we'll have to see exactly what Russia's intentions are.
Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal told VOA's Victor Beatty that while he was surprised Russia made the announcement sooner than he expected, they've achieved their objectives of propping up the Assad regime and weakening the opposition.
At the same time, remember, the Russians were having a very hard time sustaining this expenditure for two reasons. First of all, their own military does not have as many of these aircraft that they've been using as one would have assumed and expected. And their maintenance was very, very expensive. The cost of this whole operation was very high at a time when their earnings were dropping like mad. And they also knew at the same time that the Saudis would rather borrow but keep the oil prices down in order to hurt both Russia and Iran. And they seem to be succeeding in that strategy there at this moment. Now, what the Russians are trying to do is basically to say, look, we have achieved our primary objective. The peace process could very well begin, although that's a bloody sham, and I don't think much is going to happen on that front. But they have created a situation where Assad government is clearly more powerful, and they could very easily go for eliminating all the opposition they may have in places closer to the Turkish border. And under those circumstances, it could be a situation where they may, in fact, be in a much stronger position than one assumes in this United Nations-based negotiations which began today.
Western diplomats are speculating that Mr. Putin may be trying to press President Assad into accepting a political settlement to end the war.
Not necessarily. Remember, once you build up a government as strongly as they have done, there is no reason for them to back away from it. Remember, they are not going to completely abandon Assad. The specter of their intervention remains. Even though they may gradually start to withdraw some of their forces, they will clearly like to recoup their air force, which has a limited stock of these very sophisticated weapons that they've been using. But at the same time, this fear that they can come back in is very much there. The point really boils down to is they have a horse in the game, and that is Assad. We don't have any horse. So we have a problem. They don't. They can always come back. For them, there is a very clear-cut target, very clear-cut objective, which they're after. And even though they withdraw right now temporarily, they're not going to disappear from the scene.
Zubair Iqbal describes the Russian move as a tactical withdrawal. He says Moscow's surrogates from Iran and Lebanon's Hezbollah fighters will remain in Syria along with Russian weapons and equipment. As for the peace process, Iqbal calls it a sham, and he says that it will achieve only a respite for both sides to resupply and prepare for the next phase of the conflict. The Obama administration may be feeling additional pressure to designate Islamic State atrocities as genocide in the wake of a House of Representatives vote that overwhelmingly was in favor of the label. The State Department said Secretary of State John Kerry is collecting and evaluating information as part of a legal review and is expected to have a decision soon. Right now, my International Edition colleague Susan Yockey discusses the possible designation with VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins.
Well, a legal review is underway. Secretary of State Kerry has been collecting and evaluating information, we're told. He has to decide if the atrocities committed by the Islamic State meet that legal definition of genocide according to the UN Convention, which is acts intended to destroy in part or whole a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. Now, Susan, it is unclear what his decision will be and if the State Department will have that decision in time for the March 17th congressional deadline, although officials say Kerry is expected to have a decision soon. The State Department has said that it is appalled by the horrific acts of violence that have been committed by the Islamic State, but some lawmakers have indicated that is not enough. House Speaker John Ryan said the administration has been waffling on the issue while the American people have been speaking loudly and clearly about the Islamic State.
If he does agree with Congress, what does that action mean?
It's unclear what the next step would be. Congress is calling for the establishment of a war crimes tribunal. A U.S. designation could also lead to a requirement for additional U.S. action or could possibly be accompanied by a referral to the U.N. Security Council, possibly for a prosecution by the International Criminal Court or by some other tribunal. These decisions are fairly rare. The last time a Secretary of State made a genocide determination was Colin Powell in 2004. He determined that the mass rapes and slaughters in Sudan's Darfur region constituted genocide. Now, lawmaker Jeff Fortenberry, who introduced the House legislation back in September, said a genocide designation would raise what he called international consciousness and compel the international community to act, and could also set preconditions for the reintegration of ethnic groups and faith traditions.
It's unpleasant, Pam, but please share with us some of the atrocities IS is accused of committing.
It is unfortunately a long list of atrocities, including mass murders, beheadings, crucifixions, rapes, tortures, enslavements. Some of those were atrocities were outlined recently in a report by the Knights of Columbus group. The group cited a number of abuses, including cases in which Christians were murdered in front of family members, children who were taken from their parents, and also cases in which women and girls were held as hostage for long periods of time as sex slaves.
VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins. You may follow more about this story on our website at voanews.com. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. If you've ever wanted to see what life was like in another time, there's a new virtual reality app for that. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, the Time Looper app is taking people back in time at several historic sites.
If you visit the Tower of London, you will see the building with the moat drained. But if you use a new Time Looper app, the modern city melts away and you're in 1255 London. What are now city streets are fields, and the tower is surrounded by water, all by using your smartphone and a simple cardboard viewer. Andrew Feinberg is the co-founder of Time Looper, which uses virtual reality technology on your smartphone to transport you to another time.
We actually overlay the current infrastructure with what the infrastructure of the tower and the surrounding environment was like in 13th century London. So, for example, now you see a Starbucks, and now you see the tower as it looks today with the moat drain. When we take you back in time, you actually see the historically accurate representation of the tower in its heyday.
Feinberg and his co-founder, Yit Yitter, first do historical research on the sites. Then they record the modern site in 360-degree virtual reality video. Then, using a green screen and costumed actors, they recreate the site as it was in an earlier time. After some 3D modeling and some visual effects, suddenly Trafalgar Square in London is not in 2016, but in 1940 during the Nazi Blitzkrieg. Swarms of German bombers appear in the sky, and one actually drops a bomb near Nelson's Column, an iconic landmark in London. Yit Yitter says the technology enhances the experience for people who might see the modern view but have no idea what happened there.
Nothing replaces the experience of being on site, but you don't always know what the stories are about those sites. So the first thing is, experience those destinations, Colosseum, even without going there, and getting more excited about that destination. And then the second thing is, when you arrive, learning more about those stories.
Time Looper is a boon for the tourist industry, allowing visitors to see the Great Fire of London or the Thames River's Tower Bridge before it was a bridge. Ruth Poling is a Blue Badge tourist guide in London.
I think it's just really, really immersive. I mean, my job is a storyteller. I'm here to conjure up what things are like. And this just gives me something else I can use, particularly with small children, getting them really engaged in the story that I'm telling.
Chris Early, the head of Tower Bridge, says Time Looper helps people understand the impact of historical events.
You might be able to experience the looking at the Great Fire from stood at home, but when you're actually up here in the walkways, you get a sense of where it all happened. And of course, the second that the experience finished, you're looking at exactly the same view, but in the modern day. So it gives it a lot more context.
Time Looper plans to launch in New York City in April. There, visitors will be able to see Times Square on VJ Day in August of 1945. They'll also get to see workers eating lunch atop a skyscraper during construction of Rockefeller Center in 1932. Following their launch last year, Feinberg and Yitter have been busy doing deals with other locations, from China to Spain. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Isn't technology cool? Wow, you can go back in time now with an app. You know, you can always go to our website, voanews.com, download this program, and save it for your grandkids if you like them to go back in time. Or not. Thanks so much for joining us either way. We hope you have a wonderful day. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook. Come back and visit us again.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The illegal trafficking of endangered wildlife has escalated to alarming levels. In 2015, poachers killed 1,175 rhinos just in South Africa, compared to 13 in 2007. Annually, around 30,000 elephants were killed for their ivory tusks to make a profit. As a result of poaching and trafficking, many iconic endangered species are on the verge of extinction. But there is much more at stake here, said Assistant Secretary for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs William Brownfield. These crimes are not committed by small-time poachers, but by well-equipped, well-organized global criminal networks, and they are aided by a web of corrupt and criminal facilitators. These are organized, efficient, often violent, and well-funded networks. They are responsible for fueling not only the depletion of natural resources, but also undermining the rule of law, causing permanent harm to communities, local economies, and to the environment, fomenting instability, and providing a significant source of funds used by violent cartels, gangs, and even terrorists. In response to this escalation in 2013, President Barack Obama established the Presidential Task Force on Wildlife Trafficking, co-chaired by the Departments of State, Interior, and Justice, to coordinate a whole-of-government approach to stop illegal activities that threaten the future survival of many species of wildlife. This and other efforts by the United States and its partners around the globe have caused a turning point in the fight against wildlife trafficking. For example, the State Department has partnered with the NGO African Wildlife Foundation to build regional law enforcement cooperation in eastern Africa, develop a canine program in key ports in Africa, and elevate the issue of illegal online trade of wildlife. Implementation is underway. Through this partnership with AWF on a canine detection program, two dogs at Jomo Kenyatta International Airport have been deployed for routine baggage checks. It is evident that passengers are aware of their presence, and that in itself sends a very strong message to traffickers. Just in January 2016, four seizures were made at this airport. The entire world has a stake in protecting the world's iconic animals, said President Barack Obama, and the United States is strongly committed to meeting its obligation to help preserve the Earth's natural beauty for future generations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
is for...